Miriam. Fight smarter, not harder, Harry. I drew in power on the way. A lot of power. If there wasn't going to be any magic available for the taking once the symbol went up, I'd just have to bring my own. Usually, I draw in power only when it's ready to flow directly out of me again, channeling the energy through my mind and into the structure of a spell. This time, I brought it in without ever letting it out, and it built up pressure behind my eyes. My body temperature jumped by at least 4 or 5 degrees, and my muscles and bones screamed with sudden pain while my vision went red and flickered with spots of black. Static electricity crackled with every single motion of my limbs, bright green and painfully sharp, until it sounded like I was running across a field of bubble wrap. My head pounded like every New Year's hangover I had ever had, all in the same spot, and my lungs felt like the air had turned to acid. I concentrated on keeping my feet underneath me and moving, one step at a time. I pounded through the entry to the Oceanarium, felt a shivering sensation as I ran right through a veil I had not sensed was there, and all but barreled into a demonic figure crouched down on the floor. I skidded to a stop, and there was an instant of surprise as we stared at each other. The Denarian was basically humanoid, as most of them were, a gaunt, even skeletal gray-skinned figure. Spurs of bone jutted out from every joint, slightly curved and wickedly pointed. Greasy, lanky hair hung from its knobby skull to its skinny shoulders, and its two pairs of eyes, one very human brown and one glowing demonic green, were both wide and staring in shock. It was crouched amidst the preparations of a spell of some kind, a candle, a chalk circle on the floor, a cup made from a skull and filled with water, and it wore a heavy canvas messenger bag slung across one shoulder. One hand was still down in the bag, as if it had been in the midst of drawing something out of it when I'd come charging up. Fortunately for me, my mind had been in motion. His had been tangled up in whatever spell he was doing, and he was slower to get back into gear than I was. So I kicked him in the face. He went down with a grunt, and a chip of broken tooth skittered across the floor. I didn't know what spell he was getting together, but it seemed a good bet that I didn't want him to finish it. I broke his circle with my will as I crossed it with my body, unleashing a ripple of random and diffused energies that had never had the chance to coalesce into something more coherent. I knocked his skull goblet into one of the enormous nearby tanks with my staff as I raised it and pointed one end of it at the stunned Denarian, snarling,
"Fozari!"
Some of that searing storm of power I was holding in screamed out of my body and down through my staff, hurtling at the Denarian, an invisible cannonball surrounded by a cloud of static discharge. It was more power than I'd meant to unleash. If it hit him, it was going to throw him halfway across Lake Michigan. But while the Denarian's mortal set of eyes may still have been blank with shock and surprise, the glowing green set was bright with rage. The thorny Denarian lifted his left hand in a sweeping gesture, made a rippling motion of his fingers, drawing his hand toward his mouth, and he just ate my spell. He ate it, and then that gaunt skeletal face spread in a toothy smile. "That," I muttered, "is incredibly unfair." I lifted my left hand just as the Denarian crouched and vomited out a spinning cloud of black threads that came whirling through the air in dozens of tiny, spiraling arcs. I brought up my shield, but none of the threads actually came down to touch me. They landed all around me instead, in a nearly perfect circle. And an instant later, my shield stuttered and shorted out. I still had the energy for it. I hadn't been cut off. But somehow, the Denarian's weird spell had disrupted the magic as it left my body. I had tried to throw another bolt of force at him, and got to feel supremely silly waving my staff around to absolutely zero effect.
"Interruptions," the Denarian said in an odd accent. "Always the interruptions."
His left hand returned to rummaging in his bag, while his mortal eyes went back to the now scattered remnants of the spell, evidently dismissing my existence. The green eyes remained focused on me, though, and darkness suddenly gathered around the forefinger of his upraised right hand. Time slowed down. Dark light leapt toward me. Sheer defiance made me step forward, trying to brush past the little spinning columns of shadow that surrounded me,
only to find them as solid as steel bars and colder than a Yeti's fridge. I threw my magic against those bars to no avail as a shaft of dark lightning streaked toward my heart. Something happened. I don't know how to describe it. I was trying to slam another bolt of force between the bars of my conjured prison when something else got involved. Ever been carrying something and had someone intentionally, unexpectedly jostle your elbow? It felt something like that. A tiny but critically timed nudge, just as I threw my will into a last futile effort of defiance. Power screamed as it wrenched its way out of my body. It shattered the black thread bars of my prison and left a streak of metallic light on the air behind it for an instant, reflective, like a trail of liquid chrome. It caught the falling Denarian in a massive silvery simulacrum of my own fist. I actually felt my fingers close over the gaunt, skeletal, gray-skinned figure, felt the numerous spurs of bone jutting from its joints press painfully into my flesh. I flung it away from me with a cry, and the huge, silver hand flung the Denarian into the nearest wall, ripping through several feet of expensive stone terracing and carefully simulated Pacific Northwest. I stared for a second, first at the stunned Denarian, and then at my own spread fingers, and at the floating silvery hand beyond, mirroring my movements. Then the skeletal Denarian gathered itself and rose, fast as hell, until I shoved the heel of my hand forward and drove his bony ass 6 inches into the wall of rock behind him.
"Oh yeah, baby!"
I heard myself howl, elated.
"Talk to the hand!"
I picked up the thorny fiend by a leg and laughed as it raked and bit and scrabbled at the construct that held him. I could feel the pain of it, but it was a small thing, really, something I might have gotten from a rat. Unpleasant as hell, but I'd felt much, much worse, and it was nothing compared to the agony of the power still burning inside me. I slammed him into the wall again, then swung him 20 feet through the air, shoved him through a pane of unbroken 3-inch thick glass on the outer wall of the Oceanarium, drew him back through, and then rammed him through the next one, and the next one, and the one after that, cutting him to tatters as I did. I had maybe half a second's warning, as my already overloaded nerves screamed that the circle was closing, that the sign was rising, as I felt the surge of energy approaching from no more than a dozen yards away. There was still no time for a shield. So, Spiny Boy would have to do. I flung him between me and where my instinct warned me the inbound power was coming from, and then there was a roar like a dozen turbine engines howling to life in synchronization. 30 feet from me, the walls exploded in light and hellfire. Heat, light, and sheer, intangible power slammed against my senses and threw me from my feet. Bits of molten rock hissed through the air, deadlier than any bullet. Spiny Boy caught a bunch of those. They flew out his back and left gaping, smoking, cauterized holes in it. I could see them through the silvery haze of the construct hand that still held him, could feel the heat as they bored through the construct, and then my head bumped the ground hard enough to make me see stars. I rolled to my feet and nearly wobbled over the railing and into the pool with the whales. I slammed the end of my staff into the ground with my left hand and leaned heavily against it, panting. I was still alive. I still retained an agonizing amount of energy. So far, I thought woozily, everything was going exactly according to plan. A skeletal, spiny Denarian lay twitching on the ground 10 or 12 feet in front of me. There were big smoking holes in its body. One of its arms was moving. So was its head. But its legs and its lower body were completely limp. I could see the bones of its spine standing out sharply from its gaunt, emaciated back. 2 of the smoking holes intersected that spine precisely. He, or she, I supposed, if it mattered, wasn't going anywhere. Great currents of energy 8 or 9 feet thick intersected maybe 50 feet away. It was like looking at the cross-section of a river in flood, if the river had been made of fire instead of water, and if 2 rivers could have intersected and passed through each other without affecting each other's courses. I turned my head and saw, through the walls of glass that I'd broken, more of the same beams, all around the Oceanarium, in an unbroken wall. The eerie part was that the fiery current of energy was silent. Absolutely silent. There was no crackle of flame, no roar of superheated air, no hiss of steam as snow and ice melted. I heard some rubble falling, stone landing on stone. I heard a broken electrical line somewhere spitting and snapping for a few seconds before it, too, went silent. That was when I realized a couple of things. The silver energy construct that had gripped the Denarian was gone, and I couldn't feel my right hand. I looked down in a panic, but found that it was still there, at least, flopping loosely at the end of my arm. I couldn't feel anything below my wrist. My fingers were slightly curled and didn't respond when I told them to move. Crap, I muttered. Then I gathered my wits about me, gripped my staff more firmly in my left hand, and took several rapid steps until I stood over Spiny Boy. Then I bashed him over the head with a solid length of oak until he stopped moving. Immobilized wasn't the same as unconscious. He wouldn't be the only one of his kind in the building, and I didn't want him shouting my location to anybody the second my back was turned. One down. Who knew how many to go? I crouched in the walkway, with the wall on my right, the windows facing the outside of the Oceanarium on my left, and the beam of hellfire at my back. It was the most secure position I was likely to get. There was still no sound, which meant that they hadn't tried to take the archive yet. Kincaid would not go down quietly. But they were in here with me. They had to be. But they didn't necessarily know I was in here with them. That could be an advantage. Maybe even a huge advantage. Sure, Harry. What cat ever expects the mouse to come after it? I stuffed my numb right hand in my duster pocket, tried to ignore the bone-deep ache of unspent power racking my body, and the limb-weakening tremors of raw terror radiating through my guts, and stalked silently forward to sucker-punch some fallen angels.
Chapter 31. I've read that dolphins are as smart as people. I've even read one article by a researcher who claimed that her results indicated that the dolphins she'd been working with had been throwing the tests, and it had taken us years to realize it, that in fact they might be smarter than us. I'd read other positions that said that they were quite a bit dumber than that. Being as how I've never really sat down for a game of checkers with a dolphin, my own personal meter for such things, I didn't really have an opinion until the day in the shed. That was when those ugly little dolphins swam by me in perfect silence, except for the swish of their dorsal fins breaking the surface to get my attention, and then raised holy hell 70 feet farther down the path beside the pool, around the curve and out of my sight, splashing and chattering and squeaking for all they were worth. I stared stupidly for about half a second before the message got through. Bad guys sighted, and close. Evidently, the aquatic Americans had decided I was on the home team. As quickly as the chattering had begun, it ended, the dolphins vanishing beneath the surface. I heard a creaking, skittering sound, and instinct drew my face up. Shadows moved on the snow-covered glass roof of the Oceanarium. More of Nicodemus's plan in delaying me became clear. He'd needed time to let his people get into position within and atop the building, once he'd been able to determine generally where the archive was within the aquarium. I threw myself into the heavy ferns planted next to the footpath beside the outer pools, crouching down in the thickest bunch of greenery I could find. I held on hard to the power I'd drawn into me and hoped I could make my sucker punch last for more than a single hit. A breath later, glass shattered and fell. Dark, inhuman forms dropped silently from overhead. I picked the outermost of the invading Denarians, the one farthest from the center of action and attention. Pointed my staff at him from my hiding spot amidst the green, and snarled,
Fozare!
Unleashing a moderate effort of will. Invisible force caught the shape-shifted fiend as he was falling. I never got much of a look at him, beyond the fact that he had a lot of muscle and a ridge of leathery plates running down his spine. Muscle doesn't do you any good in free fall, no matter how many fallen angels you've got inside you. Unless you've got some wings to put it to use, you're in the hands of Mother Earth and Sir Isaac Newton. I wasn't trying to smash him into the middle of the lake. I applied just enough force to alter his trajectory, shoving the falling Denarian 30 feet off course, and he landed in one of those beams of titanic energy. There was a flash of white light, A brief shadow of a human skeleton burned onto my vision, and then a white-hot something went spinning out from the beam. It landed in one of the pools in an angry gush of steam. The dolphins darted away from it. Then I froze, not moving. Denarians fell like rain, more than a dozen of them, landing with heavy-sounding thumps and a couple of splashes. And a splat. One of them, a lizard-looking thing, had fallen into the foliage behind me, and not 5 feet from my hiding spot, with about two-thirds of its head simply missing from its shoulders. It twitched wildly for several seconds, pumping very human-looking blood all over the place, before it slowly went still and simply started draining. My eyes tracked up to the roof and found a darkened corner. Kincaid hung in it like a spider, suspended from some sort of harness and perfectly still, and I realized that he'd had the same idea I had. Remove them before they'd realized that the battle was well and truly begun, while they were still holding back all their power to unleash in concentration. He gave me a grim little smile, moved his head in an after you sort of gesture, and raised a rifle sporting a heavy, outsized silencer to his cheek. Kincaid had once informed me, quite calmly, that if he ever wanted to kill me, it would be with a rifle, from more than a mile away. This was more like 100 feet, maybe less, but Kincaid had dropped the Denarian with a shot to the head, maybe more than one, while it fell to the ground amidst a shower of broken glass. He was deadly as hell, and he could just as easily be coming after me as my enemies. But somehow, my terror had dwindled to something familiar and ferocious. Sure, I might be outnumbered, but I was no longer at all certain that I was outclassed. When the Fallen were calling the shots, they were arrogant to the extreme, and they weren't at all used to playing it by ear and adjusting to changes in the tempo. When the Coinbearers were running things, they could be more dangerous, but no more so than anyone else I had crossed metaphorical swords with. Nicodemus, then, was dangerous because he was Nicodemus, not because of a fallen angel or a lack of one. And while I would be a fool to think him anything less than a deadly threat, I had survived him once, and seen the trap coming this time, even if it had been at the last minute. I spared a glance for the splattered, twitching remains of the decapitated Denarian in the ferns. These creeps might have scary angels looking over their shoulders, but for the next couple of minutes at least, so did I. It didn't make them any less dangerous. It just made me see that I had a chance of standing up to them. No flash and thunder, then. I had no energy to spare for them. No wasted time, either. I rose and stole through the ferns toward where I thought the next nearest Denarian had come down, up a steep hillside that was murder to move over silently. The Denarian who had landed hadn't stayed immobile, though. I found the spread talon prints in the earth where it had touched down, like those of a turkey, but larger. I froze as water splashed off to my right. From the corner of my eye, I saw a Denarian haul herself out of the water of the dolphin pool. Mantis girl, Tessa. She pulled herself over the pedestrian guardrail, moving fast and warily. I saw a flash of silver in the talons of one hand. She'd recovered the coin of the Denarian I'd shoved into the beam. She knew they weren't alone. I didn't have much in the way of cover between her and me, but I didn't move, and I didn't think she spotted me. Mantis girl landed on the concrete and vanished down the path and out of my sight. Something let out a chittering, monkey-like sound from somewhere in the vast room, but other than that, everything remained silent. I ghosted forward again, straining to hear. Where was the drama? Where were the explosions, the howling screams, the deafening soundtrack? This was just one big eerie game of hide-and-seek, which I suddenly realized must have been the Archive's counter-strategy. The energy output of the enormous symbol was too high to maintain for long. If she could simply remain hidden from her enemies until the symbol could no longer be maintained, she could depart at will. There would be no need for her to burn through her precious little available energy in a last-ditch, desperate effort to defend herself, provided she could stay calm and focused enough to maintain a veil under these circumstances, of course. It would force the Denarians to hunt Ivy, expending their efforts on trying to pierce her veil, while Kincaid concentrated on isolating them and killing them while they were distracted. It was a deucedly clever counter-tactic. On the far side of the room, one of the Denarians started screaming, a wail of agony. My eyes snapped up to Kincaid's position. He was gone. A rope now dangled down over the foliage below where he'd hung, but he'd abandoned the exposed shooting position after taking down one more enemy, it would seem. I found myself grinning. Fine. If that was the game, I could play too. Ready or not, here I come. I pressed on through the ferns, angling over toward the amphitheater seats, and dropped into a sudden crouch as a low mutter of voices came to me.
Where is she?
Demanded a heavy, thick-sounding man's voice. I couldn't see the source of the voices from amidst the fake wilderness until I glanced up. Light and shadow played together in the room and conspired to create a reflective surface for me upon one of the panels of glass on the ceiling. Three of the Denarians had gathered on the bleacher seats. The one who spoke looked like nothing so much as a big leathery gorilla, except for the goat's horns and heavy claws.
Shut up, Magog, snarled Mantis Girl. I can't think with you running your stupid mouth.
We're nearly out of time, Magog growled.
She knows that,
snapped a third Denarian. I recognized this one, which looked like a woman, except for the reverse-jointed legs ending in panther claws, the bright red skin, and the massive metallic 10-foot-long, independently moving blades in place of hair. Deirdre, Nicodemus's darling daughter. She turned back to Tessa.
But Magog has a point, Mother. Scent tracking has been useless.
She held up a small, pink sock.
Bits of clothing with her scent on them have been scattered everywhere.
That's the Hellhound's work,
Magog spat, bright green eyes glowing brightly over dull, animalistic brown ones.
He's fought us before.
He hunts us,
Deirdre said,
while she forces us to focus on piercing a veil. They work too well together. He's killed two of us. Three, if you count Arumviel.
Tessa bounced the silver coin in her palm.
Arumviel's vessel may have been killed by his own idiocy, she said.
Her insectoid eyes seemed to narrow.
Or perhaps the wizard managed to return before the sign was raised. You think that pathetic sot bested father?
Deirdre said with scorn. I bristled.
He wouldn't need to best him, you moron, Tessa said. Only to run faster. And it would explain why Thorned Namshiel hasn't appeared as well.
Yeah, if Spiny Boy ever woke up, it would be with one hell of a Dresden hangover. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it, Dee Dee.
The wizard is nothing, Magog growled. If the girl is not found, and swiftly, none of this will matter to us.
Tessa snapped her fingers and once again did that disgusting little trick where the mouth of the mantis form opened and the head of a pretty young girl emerged, smiling.
Of course, she said, looking at Deirdre. I should have thought of it sooner.
Deirdre tilted her head. Blades whispered murderously against one another at the gesture.
Of what?
The entire strength of this plan is predicated upon attacking the child, not the archive, Tessa said, her smile turning vicious. Ignore the girl. Bring me the Hellhound. Chapter 32. It took me about a second to see what Mantis Bitch had in mind, and half that long to hate her for it. Ivy didn't have a family. Until I'd given it to her, she hadn't even had a name. She'd just been the Archive. What she had was a world of power and responsibility and knowledge and danger and Kincaid. While the Archive would know that the proper decision would be to allow Kincaid to die in order to protect the sanctity of the Archive, Ivy wouldn't be making the decision with the same detached calm. Kincaid was the closest thing she had to family. She wouldn't let them hurt him. She couldn't. Damn them. To take a little girl's loneliness and use it against her like that. Grand schemes and sweeping plans to bring doom and darkness are all fine and scary, but they at least have the advantage of being impersonal. This was simple, calculated, cruel malice deliberately aimed at a child. A child. And it pissed me off. Deirdre was the closest. Fine. I stepped out of the ferns, swept my staff in a broad, backhanded swing, and unleashed some of the power I'd been painfully holding back, snarling,
Vintas Servitas!
A burst of wind gathered underneath Deirdre, lifting her out of the amphitheater seats and throwing her out over the pool like a dart shot from a child's air gun. I'd thrown her at the nearest section of the pentagram's beam, but the instant she'd gone airborne, those snake-like strips of her hair had fanned out like a tattered parachute and began thrashing in the air, slowing her and changing her course. I didn't stop to watch where she landed. Magog spun before Deirdre's feet were more than a yard off the ground and broke into one of those diagonal simian charges, coming right up the bleachers as smoothly as if they'd been level ground. Forget what I said about not reacting quickly. Magog's reaction time had been nothing, if not a little less. He had to have checked in at 700 or 800 pounds, and he covered the 40 feet between us in the space of a couple of seconds. The acceleration incredible. Of course, reacting quickly isn't always the same thing as reacting intelligently. Magog looked like he was used to being an unstoppable force. I brought up my shield bracelet, slamming my will through it, pushing most of the painful load of power still remaining to me into the barrier that sprang to life. I shouted out in wordless challenge, my voice thin and strained beside the deep-chested bellow that Magog unleashed in answer. Normally, my shield manifests as a shimmering dome of mixed blue and silver light. This time, I left it transparent, on the theory that what Magog didn't know would hurt him. The shape-shifted Denarian slammed into the invisible barrier in an explosion of silver sparks and found it as immovable as the side of a mountain. The force of the gorilla thing's charge was not simply physical, though, and ugly red light clung to the silver power of my defenses. Excess energy bled through my bracelet as heat scalding my skin, but the barrier held, and Magog staggered back, stunned. Hey, I said as I let the shield fall. Where's an 800-pound gorilla sit? I took a step forward and kicked him as hard as I could, right in the coconuts, then followed up with a stomping kick to the neck. Magog shrieked in agony and went tumbling back down the bleachers.
Somewhere with lots of extra cushions, I guess, eh, monkey boy?
My instinct screamed a warning at me, and I threw myself down behind the last row of bleacher seats just as Mantis Bitch pointed a finger at me and screamed,
Ammo Bizo!
There was a crash of thunder, a flash of light, a wash of heat, and a cloud of glowing splinters flew up a few feet away where a section of seating had been a second before. Hell's bells. A sorceress. A damn dangerous one, too. I readied my shield, already acutely aware of how little energy remained to me. I kept it small, maybe 3 feet across, and I started to rise when I saw a shape flit into my peripheral vision above me. Tessa in the middle of an airborne leap. She cried out again, and I yelped and pulled into a tight fetal curl behind my shield as another bolt of lightning ripped through the air. Pressure slammed my shoulders against concrete floor. Light blinded me, and sound deafened me, leaving my world nothing but one long white tone. My lungs forgot their job for a couple of seconds, but my legs were on the ball, scrambling to get beneath me. I had just managed to sort out where I was when another deafening flash and crack hit somewhere close and flung me to the ground again. Then a third. I tried to keep my shield up, but I couldn't see anything but yellow spots, and there wasn't anything left to put into it anyway. It was like walking along and suddenly finding myself without any floor, which happened more literally a second later when I tripped over a bleacher seat and fell a couple of rows down, banging myself up pretty well in the process. Some dazed part of me realized that I'd made a mistake in my assumptions. Tessa wasn't trying to take me out. She was just trying to keep me dazed and disoriented long enough for her people to arrive. That same part of me realized, even more belatedly, that I'd let myself be goaded into attacking by their words, let my heart rule my decision instead of playing it smart. Something slapped my staff out of my hand. I went for my gun, only to be slammed to the ground by another terrific physical force, and something like an iron bar slammed across my throat. The light spots began to clear away in time for me to see a Denarian I'd never seen before atop me, this one like an androgynous, naked, bald statue of obsidian green eyes glowing above human eyes of bright blue. A second shape-shifted creature, this one covered in a shaggy coat of gray, dusty-looking feathers, its face a gray mass of fleshy, hanging tendrils, had my wrists pinned to the ground. Tessa stood over me, watching something on the far side of the room, her eyes narrowed.
"Don't choke him out," she snapped. "He can't talk if he's unconscious."
The obsidian statue eased up the pressure on my neck a little.
"Report,"
Tessa said.
"We think the hellhound is hiding in the bathrooms,"
came a strained sounding harsh woman's voice. "You think?"
"Varthiel and Ordeal are down, and McCullen is dead. They were searching there. The exit is watched. There's no way for him to escape the room."
"Their coins?" Tessa asked.
"Recovered, my lady."
"Thank you, Rosanna. Any other word?"
"We've found Thornhard Namshiel, unconscious and gravely wounded. There was extensive damage all around the area in which he fell."
"Yes, and yet it was done fairly quietly. It seems our intelligence on our young wizard thug was faulty. Someone, presumably Mantis Bitch, kicked me in the ribs. It hurt. There wasn't much I could do about it other than try to suck in a breath." "Very well," Tessa said. "Take Magog and Deirdre for the Hellhound. Take him alive. Do it within the next 5 minutes."
"Yes, my lady,"
Rosanna rasped. What sounded like hooves clopped away. Tessa stepped into view again, sweetly pretty face visible atop the monstrous body. She was smiling. "You're all kinds of feisty, boy. It's cute. The sort of thing my husband likes in his recruits." She kicked me again. "I find it endlessly annoying, personally, but I'm willing to play nice. Since we might work together in the future, I'll give you this chance to cooperate. Tell me where the little girl is."
"I wish I knew," I panted. "That way I could exercise free will while telling you to go fuck yourself."
She let out a playful little laugh and reached down to tweak my broken nose.
"Okay. Ow.
They say to give a man 3 chances to say no," she said.
"Save us both time and breath," I said. "No, twice. That's 3.
"Suit yourself," Tessa said. She reached into the pocket of my duster, withdrew my revolver, pointed it at my head, and pulled the trigger. I had just enough time to gawk and think,
wait, this isn't right.
The muzzle flashed. There was a loud noise. I reached for power, tried to shield, but there was simply nothing there, nothing to use. The magic was gone.
So it had to be someone else's spell that neatly intersected the bullet's course and bounced it into the shaggy feathered thing holding my arms. My stomach sank as I realized what was happening.
Ivy must have been there all along, quietly sitting on the bleachers, hidden by her veil from everything that was going on. Now she stood perhaps 10 feet away, just a young girl, her expression solemn, but her eyes and cheeks were bright with tears.
"Get away from him," she said quietly. "All of you, I will not permit you to hurt him."
I hadn't really extended my line of thinking beyond Kincaid, but of all the people who had dealt with the archive, I'd been one of the only ones to take any interest in her as anything but a font of knowledge. I'd been the one to inquire after her personally. I'd been the one to give her a name. Sad but true. I was the closest thing that little girl had to a friend. She couldn't have let anything happen to me, either. I just handed her to the Denarians. Tessa threw back her head and loosed a long, triumphant cry.
Chapter 33.
"Ivy," I said, in that tone you use with children who are up past their bedtime. "I'm better at it than you'd think, after so much time working with an apprentice. Get that veil back up and get out of here." Tessa kicked me in the ribs again, hard enough to keep me from breathing much or talking at all.
"When I want an opinion from you, Dresden," she said, "I'll read it in your entrails."
Ivy took 2 steps forward at Tessa's gesture and narrowed her blue eyes. "For the benefit of the slow, Polonius Lartessa, I will repeat myself. I will not allow you to harm him, Step away.
Tessa's eyes narrowed suddenly.
You know my name?
I know everything about you, Lartessa, Ivy said, her tone flat, passionless. It was all recorded, of course. Everything was, in Thessalonica, in those days. Your father's failing business, your sale to the Temple of Isis. If you like, I could draw you a cost-benefit analysis of your training versus your earnings in your first year at the temple, before Nicodemus came. I could use charts to make it easier for you to understand, and color them in with crayons. I enjoy crayons.
I wasn't certain, but it sounded like the kid was trying to give the bad guys some guff on my behalf. She needed to work on her technique, but it was the thought that counted. If I could breathe, I might have gotten a little choked up.
Do you think I'm intimidated that you know where I come from, child? Tessa snarled.
I know more about you than you do, Ivy replied, her voice steady. I know far more precisely than you how many you've harmed. How many bad situations you've made worse. Cambodia, Colombia, and Rwanda most recently. But whether in this century, the Wars of the Roses, or the Hundred Years' War, your story is the same stupid little story told over and over again. You learned your lessons when you were a child, and you've never swerved from them. You're a vulture, Lartessa, a maggot. You survive on diseased flesh and rotting meat. Anything whole and healthy frightens you.
The little girl didn't see the Denarian that came creeping through the ferns behind her and flung itself at her back, several hundred pounds of scales and fangs.
Ivy!
I choked out.
She had it covered. There was a flash of light, an overwhelming scent of ozone and fresh laundry, and a silver Denarius rolled away from a mound of ash that fell to the ground without ever getting within 3 feet of the small form of the archive. The coin rolled past her on a straight line toward Tessa, but Ivy stomped on it with one small shoe, flattening it to the floor and preventing it from returning to Tessa's grasp.
Tiny, I said in overblown imitation of Sonya's Russian accent, unable to keep a crazed giggle out of my voice.
But fierce.
Tessa regarded the fallen coin with a faint smile.
Costly. How many such spells do you think you can manage before you're out of energy, little one?
Ivy shrugged. How many minions can you throw away? How many will be willing to die for you?
Tessa called out.
Around her, everyone! Make sure she knows where you are!
And nightmarish forms rose around the little girl, huge beside her single, slender little form. Deidre, soaked and smelling of dead fish and seawater, gave me a sullen glare as she mounted the steps beside her mother. The shaggy, feathered thing that still held my hands bled quietly, keening under its breath. It was wounded, but it still kept my arms pinned. Magog came monkeying up over a bit of landscaping, grinning an evil grin, and I wondered where the hell Kincaid had wandered off to. The obsidian statue shifted its weight, keeping one hand resting on my chest. I had the feeling it could have shoved it right through to my spine if it wanted to. There were half a dozen others. Rosanna proved to be a rather beautiful-looking woman, the classical demoness with scarlet skin and a goat's legs, complete with leathery black wings and delicately curling horns, though her deep brown eyes were haunted beneath the demonic green glowing set. She had a bag slung on the strap over her shoulder, just like Spiny Boy, Tessa had called him Thorned Namshiel, had carried with him. Most of the others just looked big and mean, in various unsettling flavors. I guess even in hell, it's easier to find strong backs than strong brains. Ivy faced them and lifted her arms into a pose that vaguely resembled a defensive martial arts stance. It wasn't. She was preparing to manipulate defensive energies. I just hadn't ever seen anyone getting ready to do two entirely separate spells in either hand at the same freaking time before. Two questions occurred to me at that point. First, if the plan was for the Denarians to wear Ivy's magic down and then take her by main force before their trap ran out of power, why weren't they doing it already? And second, what was that hissing sound? It rose up around us, something I could just barely hear until I focused my senses on it, tuning out the musty reek and iron blood scent of shaggy feathers and the cold solidity of obsidian statue's hand. A definite, steady, hissing sound, like air escaping from a tire or hairspray issuing forth from a can. I lifted my head, twisting around enough to see through the crouched limbs of shaggy feathers, which seemed to be neither arms or legs, but something that served it as both, like the extremities of a spider. I couldn't see what it had my wrists pinned with, and I didn't want to. What I could see was a couple of leaves trembling on a nearby fern, and a gleam of metal from somewhere near the source of the mysterious hiss. Gas. The entire strength of this plan is predicated upon attacking the child, not the archive. Children have very low body mass compared to adults. A toxin dispersed in the air would be far more effective against Ivy than one of the Denarians, or even a grown person. All the bad guys had to do was pick something that caused unconsciousness and skewed heavily toward body mass, and they'd have an ideal weapon to use against her. Tessa and Nicodemus must have had several of their more capable lackeys carrying canisters of the stuff, whatever it was. Then all they had to do was open the cans and wait for her to fall. My thoughts flashed back to Thornhid Namshiel's spell, the one he'd been carrying out behind his concealing veil. A detail I barely noticed at the time suddenly leapt out at me. I'd been worried about what spell he was getting ready. I should have been paying attention to where he was getting ready to cast it. Directly underneath a set of large vents. He'd probably been getting ready to set a wind spell in motion to keep the air pumping through the vents and spreading the gas through the oceanarium. Could I smell something sort of medicine-y? Had the end of my nose gone numb? Hell's bells, Harry. This is no time either to panic or to suddenly pass out. I had to warn Ivy. I turned my head back toward her and caught Tessa's gaze halfway.
"Worked it out, did you?" Mantis Girl murmured. "If he speaks," she said, presumably to Obsidian Statue, "crush his chest."
A weirdly modulated voice issued from the general area of the androgynous statue's head.
"Yes, miss."
And then there was a whoop and a slap of air pressure against my skin, and Statue's head, and shaggy feathers too, exploded in simultaneous eruptions of distinctly different forms of gore. The statue went out like some kind of faulty street paving machine, splattering black sludge that looked like hot asphalt everywhere in a steadily spurting stream. It flung itself onto its back, then bounded to its hands and knees and started hammering its fists at the concrete. I guess it intended to smash me. I guess without a head, it didn't know that it was actually 6 feet away and digging a hole through the bleachers and into the material beneath. Shaggy Feather just fell in a welter of very human-looking, smelling, and tasting blood, and maybe 300 pounds of limp, rubbery muscle landed on my chest.
Ivy!
I screamed.
Gas! Get clear!
And then, things got noisy. A series of cracking thumps came down, faster than you could rapidly snap your fingers, and Denarians began to scream in pain and rage. I was vaguely aware of them bounding left and right and saw a muzzle flash from the far side of the oceanarium. At least I knew where Kincaid had been. Getting into a position to kill both demon-taken madmen holding me down with a single freaking bullet, since anything less would have meant my certain death.
"He is nothing!"
howled Tessa.
"Tarsiel, take the hellhound. Everyone else, the girl!"
"Come on, Harry. Time to pay Kincaid back by getting the kid clear. Somehow." My right hand wasn't moving much, and my singed left arm didn't like it, but I heaved and strained and got enough of the dead Denarian off me to let me begin to squirm out from under it. Just as I was about to pull free, a silver coin rolled out from amidst the ruined tentacles that had passed for the thing's head and dropped toward my face. I jerked my head aside in a panic. The falling coin missed touching my bare flesh by a hair, and bounced off the concrete floor. My left hand moved faster and smoother than I would have thought possible, snapping the coin from the air on the bounce as smoothly and nimbly as if it had been whole and healthy and not burned and scarred and covered in a leather glove. I looked between it and my numb, tingling right hand for a quarter of a second.
What the hell?
That was not normal. Worry about it later, Harry. I mean, sure, obviously something has happened to you, but now is not the time to get distracted. Focus. Save the girl. I jammed the cursed relic in my pocket, hoped to God my 501s didn't have a hole in them, and spun toward Ivy. I know I'm a wizard, a card-carrying member of the White Council and all. I know I'm a warden, a certified combat expert of wizard kind, a cop, a soldier, have staff, will kick ass, if you will. I thought I'd seen some real professionals in action, the top of the wizarding game. I was wrong. It wasn't that Ivy was slinging around a ton of power. She wasn't. But think about this one for a moment. What's really more impressive? A giant truck rumbling around on a great big old smoking engine? Or a little car, just barely big enough to get the job done, that's powered by a couple of AA batteries? 7 of them were going after Ivy with magic, and she was countering them. All of them. Magog had charged her as he had me, but she hadn't slammed him to a stop with a brick wall. She'd trapped him inside some kind of frictionless bubble, and he was spinning uselessly in circles half an inch off the floor, every motion making him spin faster. Whatever additional metaphysical mass he'd brought to the fight hadn't cramped her style much. Her arms, bobbing and weaving continuously between all the workings she had up, flicked by the field containing him every few seconds, and I swear, struck his whirling snare for no reason other than to impart an additional nausea-inducing vector to his spin. Deidre's tangle of living locks danced with purple St. Elmo's fire, lashing out in a deadly webwork, but Ivy constantly cast out a spinning cat's cradle of light, tiny, tiny threads of power that did not so much stop any of Deidre's attacks as they fouled any one of her locks with others near it, tangling them together into useless clumps, sort of an enforced bad hair day. On the opposite side of Ivy, Rosanna launched more traditional lances of flame from her open palms, much like the ones I... A savage pain went through my skull for a second, son of a bitch. But Ivy dispersed them with delicately applied wedges of air, intercepting each burst of fire far enough short of her body to prevent the bloom of heat as they died from scorching her. Though the two more physical Denarians, who strained to force their way past the barrier of snapping sparks that formed whenever they tried to get close, had far less luck. The Hellmaid's flames scorched them badly. The 6th, a wizened little thing that looked like a caricature of a woman carved from a dried tree root, seemed to be holding the end of a rope of liquid shadow that curled like a hungry serpent, darting now and then toward Ivy's head. Ivy faced it down steadily, moving her head calmly in a dodge once, swatting it aside with a little burst of silver energy a second later. But mostly, she faced an amused-looking Tessa, who apparently, just for the fun of it, threw another thunderbolt at her now and again. That told me something right there. It told me Tessa was no punk sorceress. She was White Council material herself, if she could make that much flash and bang while expending that little energy. Either that, or she'd been able to hold back one whale of a lot more power than I had when she took her deep breath before the battle. Either way, she was a big leaguer, and Ivy's response to the attack confirmed it. Each time the archive turned to fully face Tessa, and each time she dedicated one of her hands entirely to the defensive measure used to stop the incoming spell. Gulp. Holy moly. It was one thing to have an academic appreciation that I still had a lot to learn about magic. It was another to see a demonstration of exactly how much I still couldn't do. In another circumstance, it would be humbling. In this one, it was freaking terrifying. For maybe 10 seconds, I stood there trying to figure out how the hell to help without getting myself incinerated, skewered, or otherwise obliterated without accomplishing anything. I felt a little surge of dizziness. The gas levels must be rising. Screw it. The only reason someone hadn't killed me already was because I was so impotent at the moment that no one gave a damn what I did.
I might be able to get the kid to another part of the building, out of the gas. And if someone killed me on the way, I could try to level my death curse on them, maybe get her out of this mess. So I rushed toward her, trying to use the hot zone and the trapped Magog as shields, and said,
Ivy, come on.
Something took a swipe at me, and several feet away, my gun went off. I ducked, but I guess Tessa wasn't much of a shot. I didn't get hit. A second later, I grabbed Ivy by the waist and lifted her to my hip.
Keep clear of my arms, please, Ivy commanded.
I made sure to. I was getting dizzier, but anywhere was better than here.
His legs, Tessa commanded.
I had a feeling that those people tried to do a lot of disturbing things to my pins, but I didn't stop to watch them try it. I ran for the stairs, trusting the skill of the archive to keep me mobile. It was a good bet. Ivy murmured and waved her arms the whole while, and I felt her little body tingling with the live current of the energy she was working. She was using what power she had left for all it was worth, but it wasn't bottomless. She was running dry. This fight was almost over.
Time, I thought, muzzily, panting. We just need a little more time.
Gravity suggested that I keep on going down, and it seemed an excellent idea. I staggered down the stairs into the lower level, running past the underwater vistas of the whale and dolphin tanks. Past the cute penguins and the sea otters, the Denarians in pursuit, their sorceries flashing past us while Ivy shielded us with the last bits of energy in her reservoir. I felt it when she was dry, and labored to keep my legs moving, to keep ahead of the pursuit. Then the ground hit me with an uppercut. Everyone else in the Oceanarium suddenly fell sideways. Or wait, maybe it was me. I realized belatedly that given that I'd been at ground level near that one container, and breathing hard with pain and exertion to boot, I'd probably given myself a nice large dose before I'd ever gotten up. Furthermore, if the gas was heavier than air, there was probably even more of it down here than there had been up in the bleachers. I had bought us a few seconds. It just hadn't been time enough. Ivy landed beside me. She blinked, and her eyes abruptly went wide with panic. She lifted her arms again, but they came up slowly, sluggishly, and her fingers stayed half closed, like a sleepy child's. The black rope spell wrapped around Ivy's throat, and dozens of Deidre's tendrils twined around her arms and legs. They jerked her out of my sight. I looked up to find the Denarians standing as a group in the hallway, lit by the eerie blue light coming in from the big tanks. Rosanna stared intently at Ivy for a moment before she shuddered and folded her dark bat wings around herself, shivering as if with cold, and turned away from the scene, her glowing eyes narrowed. She reached into the bag and produced another canister. She offered it to Tessa without being prompted. Tessa took it, twisted something on the nozzle, and gave Ivy a polite smile. Then she quite literally jammed the nozzle into the little girl's mouth and held it there. Ivy panicked and cried out. I saw her kick and twist. She must have bitten her tongue or cut her lip on one of her teeth. Blood ran from her mouth. She bucked and fought uselessly for a few seconds and then went ragdoll limp.
Finally, Tessa said, expelling her breath in irritation. Could it have been any more annoying?
Damn you, I slurred. I shoved myself up to one knee and glared at Tessa.
Damn you all. You can't have her.
Cliched, Tessa sing-songed. Boring.
She tapped her chin with one claw hand.
Let me see. Where were we when we were so rudely interrupted? Ah,
she stepped closer, smiling cheerily, and lifted my .44. Just then, I felt the snap of magic rushing back into the Oceanarium as the enormous symbol collapsed and the circle fell. I took my frustration and rage and turned it into raw force, screaming,
Fozari!
I didn't direct it at Tessa and her crew. I aimed it at the glass wall that was the only thing between all of us and 3 million gallons of seawater. The force of my will and my rage lashed out and shattered the wall into powder. The sea came in with a roar, one enormous impact that felt like the strike of a hammer being applied to every square inch of my body at once.
and it was cold and black.
Chapter 34. The next thing I knew, I was coughing, and my chest hurt, and my head hurt, and everything else hurt, and I was colder than hell. I choked in a breath, and felt my body getting ready to send up everything. I tried to roll onto my side and couldn't, until someone pulled on my coat and helped me. Fishy salt water and whatever had been in my stomach came out in equal proportions. "Oh," someone said. "Oh, thank you, God." Michael, then.
"Michael!"
Sonya shouted from somewhere nearby.
"I need you!"
Work boots pounded away at a sprint.
"Easy, Harry," Murphy said. "Easy."
She helped me turn back over when I was done puking. I was lying at the top of the stairs to the lower level. My lower legs were actually on the stairs. My left foot was in cold water to the ankle. I put a hand on my chest, wincing. Murphy smoothed the hand over my head, brushing hair and water away from my eyes. The lines in her face looked a little deeper, her eyes worried.
"CPR?" I asked her. My voice felt weak. "Yeah, guess we're even," I said.
"Like hell we are," she said quietly. "I only spit fruit punch into your mouth." I laughed weakly, and that hurt too. Murphy leaned down and rested her forehead gently against mine.
"You are such an enormous pain in my ass, Harry. Don't scare me like that again."
Her fingers found mine and squeezed really tight. I squeezed back, too tired to do anything else. Something brushed my foot, and I nearly screamed. I sat up, reaching for power, raising my right hand, while invisible force gathered around it in shimmering waves. A corpse floated in the water, nude, face down. It was a man I had never seen before, his hair long, gray, and matted. His limp, outstretched hand had bumped against my foot.
"Jesus, Harry," Murphy said, her voice shaking. "He's dead. Harry, it's okay. He's dead, Harry."
My right hand remained where it was, fingers outspread, ripples of light flickering over them. Then they started shaking. I lowered my hand again, releasing the power I'd gathered, and as I did, I felt my fingers tingle and go numb once more. I stared at them, puzzled. That wasn't right. I was fairly sure that I should be a lot more worried about that than I was at the moment, but I couldn't put together enough cohesive thought to remember why. Murphy was still talking, her voice steady and soothing. I dimly realized a minute later that it was the tone of voice you use with crazy people and frightened animals, and that I was breathing hard and fast despite the lack of any exertion to explain it.
"It's all right, Harry," she said. "He's dead. You can let go of me."
That was when I realized that my left arm had pulled Murphy tight against me, drawing her across my body and away from the corpse as I'd gotten ready to do whatever it was I had been about to do. She was at the moment more or less sitting across my lap. Wherever she was touching me, I was warm. It took me a moment to figure out exactly why it was a good idea to let her go. Eventually, though, I did. Murphy slid carefully away from me, shaking her head.
"God," she said. "What happened to you, Harry? What did they do to you?"
I slumped, too tired to move my foot out of the water, too tired to explain that I'd failed to stop the demons from carrying away a little girl. After a moment of silence, Murphy said,
"That's it. I'm getting you to a doctor. I don't care who these people think they are. They can't just waltz into town and tear apart my..."
She broke off suddenly.
"Huh. What do you make of this, Harry?"
She took a step down into the water and bent over.
"No!"
I snapped. She froze in place. "Jesus, those things get predictable," I muttered. "Silver coins fall out of the corpse's fingers." Murphy blinked and looked at me.
"Yes. Evil. Cursed. Don't touch it."
I shook my head and stood up. The wall had to help me, but I made it all the way up, thinking out loud on the way.
"Okay. We gotta make sure there's no more of these lying around, first thing. I'm already carrying one. We limit the risk. I carry them all for now, until they can be properly disposed of."
"Harry," Murphy said in a steady voice, "you're mumbling, and what's coming through is making a limited amount of sense."
"I'll explain. Bear with me."
I bent over and found another stained denarius gleaming guiltily in the water. Moron, I muttered at the coin, and picked it up with my gloved hand and put it in my pocket, along with the